This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
So I thought I would start by just giving you a little bit of a history about how this piece came to be for John Cage, because it very much takes its cues in the Slot iteration of it from John Cage. So in 1989, John Cage was 76 years old, and he was invited to participate in an invitational-only conference in Telluride, Colorado, called Composer to Composer. And in this invitational setting, there were 10 composers, and they each were given a period of time to speak about their present concerns, whatever they were working on with each other, very, very close sessions. And then in the evenings, they would give concerts that were more public. Why I bring this up, because this is a couple of, 6 weeks before this piece came into being, John Cage, in a session with another composer, it was actually the other composer's session, whose name was Anthony Davis. Anthony Davis, I have actually lost touch with Anthony Davis, but at the time, Anthony Davis is an African-American composer who was a teacher, I think, then at Harvard, but he was mostly known for an opera that he had just completed on Malcolm X. The opera was called X. But Anthony Davis was a very, very veteran improviser, a jazz player of some renown. And his concern, as he expressed in his short presentation, was how to incorporate improvisational activity into otherwise fully notated scores. And John Cage, uncharacteristically, kind of dismissed it as a worthwhile pursuit. Because John Cage, as the trope goes in Cage circles, didn't like improvisation. So John Cage basically said, oh, well, I just don't think it's a useful thing. And Anthony Davis got a little miffed. And this was, it went down in Cage circles as a very unusual occurrence for John Cage to kind of have an irritated moment with someone else. And it recurred over the course of the next few days. People said, gee, have you rearranged your thinking about this? And John Cage did, in fact, come to some peace about it, which I actually write about this in some detail in the little pamphlet to the Slot Foundation installation booklet and CD, which is available here. Why I bring this up is that 6 weeks later, Cage attended another invitational-only conference, this one at Nicasio at the Luke Skywalker Ranch. It was the Bay Area Radio Drama Conference, also invitational, in which, in the program, he was scheduled to give a performance of a portion of a piece that he had previously written, 7 years earlier, called James Joyce, Marcel Duchamp, Eric Satie, and Alphabet, a radio play that he had created for Cologne's WDR, the West German radio. On the day of the performance, the scheduled day of the performance, however, what he did was he stood up and he delivered this piece. And this piece, as he himself says in the introduction to the piece, which is both in recorded form here and in transcript in the booklet, basically says that improvisation has been somewhat antithetical to his way of thinking, and that the last time he remembers improvising was in the mid-60s, within the context of a festival in Michigan. Of course, he was referring to the Once Festival in 1965, at which time, as he recounts, he improvised on the rooftop of the building with the pianist David Tudor. That was the last time he remembered. And then he performed this piece. So the piece, in essence, I don't know how versed you all are with what the piece is or how it's constructed, but the piece is fairly simple, but it involves the collaboration of not only an audience, but a collaboration of sound engineers. Basically, what he did was write down 10 items, 10 topics, 10 issues, things of interest to him at that time on a piece of paper, and through chance operations, extemporized on each of these 10 topics in turn, in random order. As he was doing the first one, extemporizing on the first one, the sound engineers were recording his performance. He then stopped. He then extemporized on the second subject. While he was extemporizing on the second subject, the sound engineers were playing back the first, so that what you were hearing was the second on top of the first. Those were then captured. When you performed the third, you were listening to it within the context of playback of one and two, so that you're listening to John Cage thinking out loud, but you're listening to 10 topics in a layered collage of ideas, so that things are filtering in and out, or permeating. Ideas are permeating one another. The piece kind of came and went. Cage didn't really speak of it after that. We got the recording from the Skywalker people. It came in the mail. It was a little simple cassette tape with the original program in it that listed the alphabet performance. I said to Cage, I was not in attendance, I said, what is this? He said, oh, that's the talk I gave out in California. I said, oh, and put it away. And it resurfaced, really, for me about a year ago at the Cage Trust. So I run the John Cage Trust, which is both a kind of business entity that represents Cage around the world, but we also have an archive, a very substantial archive now situated at Bard College. And I came across this. I had transcribed it way back when Cage was still alive and just put it away. And so here I had this recording, and it all of a sudden dawned on me, a solid 20 years later, that this piece was rather shocking in a way, because it was Cage improvising, number one, which of course we in Cage circles know that Cage doesn't improvise. So it really caused me to rethink the whole notion of improvisation with John Cage. But it also struck me as a particularly beautiful invitational piece for people, not only to hear others speak, but perhaps even more than that, for people to perform it themselves. That there is something quite interesting about extemporizing on topics of interest in your own life, doing them at random, and then hearing them layered back and forth. So at that point, I got rather excited. This was about a year ago, and that's as Aaron just recounted. I happened to be with Arthur and his partner Marilyn, who's right here, one day in New York, and I said, I've got this project, I would love to see something happen. And Arthur said, I think I have the perfect person for you. And that's how Aaron entered the picture. So Slot being, from where I sit, uniquely interested in public engagement through artwork and in artwork, not just talking about artwork, but really engaging in the process of art making and the whole, the mind of art, if you will. It seemed like the perfect project for Slot. So we began a conversation. And what you're seeing, the piece now has gone through some transformation since it came to Slot. It is really, to my way of thinking, somewhat different than, not only different than the way Cage did it, but different than the way we conceived of it being in the beginning. So maybe we can talk about that a bit, you and I.
Hey, Arthur, do you want to jump in?
Well, thank you. Arthur Sabatini, and indeed we were walking across near Gramercy Park when Laura brought this up in conversation, which you hear us use the word conversation again and again. And I think if there's something extraordinary about the Slot Foundation and my years of talking with Aaron and other members of the Slot community, that conversation and language and speech and thinking and ideas are very prevalent concepts and prevalent, active, engaged notions. And Cage's work is remarkable in its extensive way of incorporating language and thinking and text and silence and movement and inner speech and processes of surprise brought about by using chance operations or opening the mind up to the sounds around. So in conversation with Aaron initially, he got it almost immediately, as did Jean-Michel and others who were involved in thinking about how we could install this. And it was exciting in all of the ways that you could imagine. And then we actually had to come to do it. And there lies the issues. Because as with so much of Cage's work and ideas, there's a kind of surface invitation that has both a simplicity and an elegance and a formality to it. But underneath, it begins to suggest complicated notions of actual performance, complicated senses of this borderline area between speaking and singing and performance and everyday life. This particular piece requires, in the way that it was realized, by both in terms of its physical installation, Ken Saylor, and through Peter Price's uses of technologies to realize that audio made us come to think even more about how intricate and elegant the piece was. So you have to sit, first of all, you have to have 10 ideas, and you have to begin to sit and speak through them in this improvisational way. And you have the model of John Cage doing this performance, and so, of course, it sounds elegant and easy and possible. And he had far more than 10 ideas to share with us throughout his life. And as you begin to perform through it, as Laura has did quite extraordinarily today, and as I flubbed my way through, it begins to make connections between the way in which you speak to others, the way in which you frame language and ideas, the way in which you speak in terms of your own inner thoughts and speech, and how it becomes realized. Laura has mentioned again and again that this idea from Cage about thinking in public came to the fore. He was an extraordinary talker, an extraordinary conversationalist, and there's a depth to that sense of how language and conversation and dialogue and the sort of meeting of voices creates a moment, creates a frame, creates a kind of a breakdown also between a sense of art and life and a sense of an aesthetic making and receiving. And these dynamics start to appear as you think through the ways in which to perform this piece and the ways in which you can reveal what you are thinking, but then overshadowed by or informed by the structure that Cage has set up of this repetitive notion of 10 frames in which you speak through. So the piece is remarkable. It also echoes and has allusions to other pieces, Alvin Lussier's I Am Sitting in the Room, the kind of extemporaneous performance pieces of someone like David Anton. Even I think of Beckett's remarkable play of Inner Voices, Company. So this is all this quite late modernist and also early and always perennial sense of what are the languages of our mind and how are they organized and how both verbally and musically and sonically and orally we construct making meaning. And all of these things begin to wave over you as you participate in the work. That is as much in the concept of it as well as in the execution of it as well, which Cage never conceived of, but Laura brought to bear and Ken has come to realize in the environment in which you're coming to do this. And so the design of the space and the construction of the performance situation became very crucial figures to pick up on. And again, to emphasize the sense of conversation, as we all met and got to know each other, although Laura and I have known each other for quite some time, as Peter as well, that the way in which we all had to find and pick apart and parse the implications of the sense of space, the sense of the recording, the ideas underlying the piece, the idea of slot and its meanings, and Cage's concept and its potentialities for realization became part of all of the dimensions that make this piece that we've got us very excited about. And in that sense, the way in which Ken Saylor has put together this space and this installation became even more incredibly suggestive, and I think maybe that's something that Ken should talk about or so. Great.
I will get back to your question.
Oh, it's fine.
As has been discussed, this has been an incredible conversation amongst ourselves, to myself, to history, to Cage. And initially, when this project was discussed, I have to say, for me personally, it was daunting. The way of Cage on cultural production is vast. And I could say I froze. And it was only sort of through Aaron's prodding that I was able to perform. So finally, and I think this is a very interesting question, we talked about this earlier, about the historicity of what does it mean to reproduce a work of John Cage from 1989 in a much different and radically different context, in an unused bank vault, which is so incredibly, well, steel-lined bank vault, which is such a live spatial instrument to begin with, and only speaks to the beauty of Peter's work and basically being able to tune and make that instrument perform. In thinking about Cage's work and the reinstallation of How to Get Started, I tried to sort of really strip things back and really take on some almost like the most simplistic and elemental aspects of what does it mean to, or what does it take to produce sound in space. And basically, we need three things. We need a source, which in this case is Cage's voice, your voice, or a performer's voice, a medium, our space, and then finally, a receiver, someone who's going to hear that, either the person performing the work, an audience, or a person passing by. And basically, those are the three elements that if you wanted to go into this exhibition and sort of deconstruct it, those are the three elements that are there. And then for me to draw attention to those and then to just sort of solve some of the fundamental utilitarian problems, I just created a frame that basically frames our space, frames our source, frames our audience, and frames the receiver. So that's what you see, sort of the graphic transformation of that space into a kind of proscenium in a way. Now, the space also has to function as a kind of hybrid in that it functions as a performance space, as a recording studio at some moments, and at other moments is functioning as an exhibition. So it's this interesting sort of hybrid space that takes on many different forms. Lastly, what I found most interesting about, I've listened to this infinite times, and it's an incredible piece of work. And for me, in that I do engage in a kind of spatial practice of architecture and design, the spaces that are inherent in this work are remarkable in that there's a simultaneous spatialization, an internal spatialization that occurs simultaneous to an external spatialization. So we've tried to make that somewhat evident in the exhibition as well, that as the space of Cage's work or the performer's work is externalized, it's simultaneously internalized. And I think you'll also find that I'm not sure I could perform the work. Laura, she nailed it today. Arthur, who's a veteran as well, worked through it. And now it's up to you guys to really take this on. And I guess lastly, what I would like to say is, for me, every exhibition is participatory, and I will always privilege reception and the viewer as opposed to the intent of the work. In this case, the intent was so good that it bumped up a bit. But in this project in particular, and upon this crew's invitation, I can't think of any other sort of contemporary projects that ask or invite or engage the level of participation and thought that How to Get Started asks for.
I'll just say a few words of what I've been thinking about today. I mean, my thoughts on the piece have changed so much over the past year of thinking about it. But today was a long day, so I'll just think about today. I was thinking about two things. One, the process of virtualization. Because for me, I'm creating software to do some things that did exist as either hardware objects like tape recorders and mixing boards, or as processes like real-time improvisation by sound engineers that were making choices in real-time in collaboration with Cage. And in creating software, you're going through this process of virtualizing objects and human relationships. So I've been thinking about that a lot today. And then I was also thinking a lot about language and the relationship of language to music. I think the real beauty of this piece is that it exists in this nexus between language and music. And I was reminded of Avital Ronell, who always says, who has said that music is the rebabilization of language. And in a way, you know, trying to do this piece is to come up against that limit of babilization, you know. And when you find the music in it, you learn something really intense about language, as I think you did beautifully today.
Thank you. Maybe I want to contextualize all of this a little bit. That at the Cage Trust, there are kind of two extreme activities that go on in the Cage world, and then lots of things in between. But those extremes are the reproduction of John Cage's works as John Cage did them, the historical integrity of performance. And on the other extreme will be the samplers out there, the liftings, the mashups using Cage, the extreme derivative, almost, I would call them almost derivative works. And then there's lots of things in between, obviously. I think that how to get started, I think that one of the reasons that it's been so engaging for all of us is that it was virtually impossible to replicate 20 years later the way Cage did the piece. That we were not, for a variety of reasons, I suppose we could have if we had set out to do that, but what we wanted to do was do the piece here at Slott. And the circumstances of Slott, the room that was carved out for it, the whole everything about Slott, dictated to us that we had to understand this piece in a different way, or even not in a different way, but we really had to understand this piece. No fooling. Do you know what I mean? That when we were pressed with, as Ken was alluding to, that we were pressed with too much liveness, Peter can address the room. There was just too much liveness, so that you can't amplify sound and play back sound and capture sound all at the same time in this space that has an unknown fundamental?
Yeah.
The room itself has an unknown fundamental for those musicians among us, which is a very fun idea, which means that the harmonics are unknowable as well. So anyway, you get chaos when you try to do those three things. So in adapting the room, in adapting the piece to the room and the circumstances of the room, forget Slott for a second, let's just have the room in isolation, we really had to understand the piece. We had to go back to the piece over and over again. What are the fundamentals of this composition? What is it that's most important? If we're going to change something, are we hurting something by changing it? So I think that's partly why it's been an intense process of understanding the piece, is because we've had to.
And along with that, of course, is Slott's overall remarkable history and agenda, being both, again, open and participatory, but also self-reflexive, also interested in and often engaged in projects of archiving and projects of maintaining ideas and furthering artists' understanding and activity, Cage being an artist through the late 20th century, probably the most important artist in that area, and many figures within the Slott history of exhibition have been artists of that generation, some William Anastasia and a couple of others directly involved with Cage over the years. So there's this kind of also incredible sort of not only the unconscious of the work itself, but the conscious and cognitive and futuristic looking aspects of Slott's work itself. And I'm saying this because Aaron is a little bit too modest to really bring about all of this, but his generative and generous and incredible attention to all the details and elements of this has also made this a great deal of fun, and we should let him speak a little bit more about that.
So I guess I want to go back to this concept that I guess I was introduced to, not necessarily the concept, but the framing of it, the language to describe it, the further life of a work. And this was something that emerged in a presentation here maybe 2 years ago. It was a book on Gary Hill's work. We had a large show of Gary Hill and George Quashen, with a foreword by Lynn Cook. George and Lynn had kind of explored this idea of the further life of a work. And throughout this project, I think we all as a team, but I in particular felt like this was a project that had a fidelity to what Cage did in 1989, and that the only way to maintain that fidelity today would be through something like this. And so we've been struggling, I think, how to navigate both a historical concern for the work, and it's defined somewhat autonomously, and this understanding that the only way, at least in my habituated way of thinking about an artwork, the only way to remain true to it is to, in a way, reinstall it and redefine and represent it. I feel like this was a tension that was always there, although in the last week or two, of course, it took different dimensions as we tried to figure out, should we privilege the recorded experience that we have from the recording?
Right, going back to what Ken was saying about it's having to do double duty or triple duty.
Right. Are we supposed to create this installation on the model of the only residue we have, that recording, and the auditory qualities of it? Or are we supposed to privilege what we also know as a defining aspect of it, which was that it took place in public, and one wasn't just thinking in public, but a public was hearing these layers play out in front of them, and the performer was being implicated by hearing their voice layered back upon them. I mean, these contradictions like defined it throughout, and so there's a part of me which doesn't feel like the last week or two was all that different from the questions we were thinking about in the beginning. But then again, there was a way in which maybe I was projecting onto you kind of the trust that kind of is responsible for the preservation of this work and all of its historicity. And maybe we were, you know, maybe we were being projected as the experimental space is always at risk of kind of losing a fidelity to the work itself.
Mm. Well, I mean, excuse me, I'm coming down with a cold, so. As we were talking today, that there are a couple ways to be the John Cage Trust. I mean, one of the things that one could do, and there would be a lot of agreement in the world, is to, you know, be very adamant about historical representation of things and towing the line about how things have been done and maintaining that. And it has always been the position of the John Cage Trust for what is now 18 years that handling of Cage, if you will, happens almost automatically in the world. There will always be people who are interested in historical reproduction and the caretaking of those things. And that really what the Cage Trust would do, and this, I won't say it was a conscious, like it wasn't written in our bylaws, but it, from the beginning, and it's always been a guiding spirit, and that includes Merce Cunningham was on our board, Ann Darnincourt was a founding board member, that our position was really that we wanted to nurture and to see what Cage would do in the world now at any given moment. So what was happening with Cage in the world now? So that necessarily meant that as the work goes out in the world and people engage with it and make new things with it and put on performances, that it was going to be different, that there were going to be subtle shifts, that there were going to be new arrangements, new technological uses, so that I think was all along, Aaron, less concerned about that than you, because it's our position. So as long as I feel that the presenter, in this case you're far more than a presenter, but the person that I'm working with that is going to house the presentation, if you will, as long as they're true to the spirit of the work and understand the fundamental things about this piece, what were critical about it, then you can do almost no wrong. You know what I mean? Because we really want you to take the work into the new world. And no one felt this more than Peter, I think. And that was particularly true this last week. I think that he was under the gun the worst because of the recording and just the whole sound installation aspect of it.
But I also got the sense that Peter understood that it wasn't a question of a right or a wrong. It was a question of completely different, almost articulations.
Right, and isn't that great? Yeah. I mean, it's just so great that question gets put back to you.
Yeah. My nutshell answer to that, and it was really just revealed today so clearly, is that performative authenticity equals conceptual fidelity. So this piece is entirely about trying to figure out what is really the concepts at issue in this piece and being loyal to the concepts, not trying to reproduce a particular historically bound performative situation.
And the performative about it also is an incredible juxtaposition in the way we've wind up framing it between this ephemerality and momentariness of the voice against the idea of the repetition of that voice, which is what we're used to in the age of mechanical reproduction, but then the final placement of it on an archive space for an engagement. So from the very momentary sense in the articulation of ideas and continuation of them, and the way of nuancing and bringing forth that voice and the mixes. The great complexity of this piece is how the mixes of your own voice come back as they are replayed, as you speak again. Again, coming to this question of an approximation of some form of reflexiveness and inner speech playing itself out. And then that, again, becomes part of the larger mix that one experiences. And it's also about this idea of ideas, how to begin again, how to start again. So it's a kind of Cajun, also punning internal to that. How to begin, how to get started, is happens every time you pick up a new idea. So it's remarkable dimensions in that sense as well.
There's an archival dimension to the project. Of course, we've already spoken to that. But it will play out, and for us it will also be a learning experience. We've had many, many discussions for the last year as to how to curate, if they should be curated at all, the performances, the recordings, the residues that emerge from this installation. And should they be curated at all? Should the website be a kind of an archive that just registers all the engagements with the piece? Would there be an engagement that would be more, let's say, true to the spirit of the piece? Could one even speak in that way? These have been questions that we really haven't ever really arrived at a clear answer to. Should the console in the space have the same recordings that are featured on the website? All of these are kind of open questions that we're still feeling out.
I think something got clarified for me today in a really special way. And I really, really encourage people, all of you, tell all your friends, to really come and do this. Because in the doing of it today, I realized that a lot of things that Arthur's talked about are experientially so. You know, so it's a very fine line, for example, between being in a small space like this, you know, talking essentially not to a big audience, but really doing this very intimate sort of piece with just a few people around, that there is this tension, if you will, between speaking and performing. Especially because you know, I mean, speaking of archiving and whether or not it's going to go on the internet and who's going to be able to hear this, and the whole notion that once you're done, you've now got this thing that becomes publicly available, it becomes something out in the world. It becomes an object that you made. You know, these are your 10 thoughts. But the beauty of the piece really resides in how closely you can do what Cage did, which is to just speak on subjects of interest to you in the space of this. You know, so there's a tendency, by the way. I mean, for example, as you're realizing the piece, you hear yourself realizing one or two or three or more stories or more of your iterations that you've done, to hesitate, to hear things, to pace yourself against that. Thereby interrupting the natural sort of talking, the natural sort of storytelling way that you might otherwise talk about a single subject for just a few minutes. And these are brief, by the way. Each one of these is, in Cage's performance, he never exceeded 3 minutes on any single subject. So they're quick, you know, they're just a few minutes. So I think the actual performance of the piece, or you were just getting to that, the actual performance of the piece is the piece. Do you know what I mean? I mean,
well,
it's the performance of it that makes the piece.
Yes, very much so. And that's, again, where Peter and the idea that you're in a space that is so remarkably suggestive and seductive and one place and graceful and elegant, and the quality of the sound that you'll hear both in Cage's voice and the way it's recorded through there, but also as you hear other voices come through, and Peter's tuning of the room. You can't just, it's an amazing idea. You start to realize how you have to hear where you are and hear yourself speaking in that place. But I also want to point out this another deceptively
complex element in this. Cage says, get 10 ideas. Well, you know, we have ideas all every day. Let's go out to dinner tonight. Hey, you know, I have an idea. Let's go to a vacation. Let's do that. Actually having an idea and doing something about it, articulating it, carrying it through, putting it in relation to another idea, is a pretty formidable set of projects when you're thinking about it. You can list down, you know, things to do, ideas I have, and then to actually then commit to the performance of the utterance that constitutes those ideas, and then hear them played back to yourself as you're doing it, sets up a kind of way of again, being both reflexive and internalized and externalized at the same time, which makes those ideas both have within the qualities of voice an ability to float, an ability to seduce, an ability to tell stories, and an ability to fill space. And it makes a kind of remarkable density to the notion of the word as it's coming forth, and the kind of embodiment that the word has, the kind of vocalization and sound that is picked up by the microphones. You were thinking about that.
Yeah, well, no, I was also thinking about, for me, an important dimension of the piece is the nature of the interactive engagement. I think there's a lot of work, there's a lot of experiences that we have technologically that provoke sort of superficial interaction. And we knew that we did not want to do something like this. And I think what this project does is instead encourage a very in-depth engagement. And that sets the bar kind of high for people coming from the outside. But it's exciting, you know, because whenever something's going on in that room, it's going to have an excitement to it that's intrinsic to the experience.
Laura, I want to kind of provoke you, maybe. Earlier today, we're talking over lunch, and you had said, well, you know, Aaron, your interest here is not so much the work, but it's representation, it's reinstallation. Would you feel that that was like an accurate characteristic for what you're trying to articulate at that time?
And I want to say that I said it in a much nicer way. I think I said that it's a perfect piece for you, uh-huh. because it's a piece that's fraught with thinking uh-huh. and ideas, and it isn't a static single thing. I mean, the reinstallation of how to get started is about other people. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's not about John Cage, really. I mean, he just gave us a model. I mean, he did it, and he did it really beautifully. And we said to ourselves, wouldn't it be great if other people did this? You know, wouldn't you like to hear? And we were fantasizing about who we'd like to hear perform How to Get mm-hmm. Started. Mm-hmm. You know, wouldn't you love to hear Salman Rushdie mm-hmm. tell you what the 10 things he's thinking about? I'd like to put, you know, 10 top educators in the world and get them to tell me their 10 things that they're thinking about right now. So it was a way, I think for Slot it's perfect because you're interested mm-hmm. in what people think. Mm-hmm. You're interested in the way people think and what they're mm-hmm. thinking about. You're also interested in sharing. Mm-hmm. You're interested in the interpenetration of mm-hmm. ideas. And it's, I think it's just made for you.
Do you think that like, let's say one of these top educators, or let's say Salman Rushdie, comes here and participates. Do you think of that as something that redefines Cage's work? Do you archive them alongside each other as we do here, as we would here? Do you think of them as one work that just kind of grows and evolves, a process that unfolds, or do you think of them as categorically kind of different?
No, I think of them all as performances of How to Get Started. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a piece by John Cage that other people realize. Mm-hmm. So it's no different for me than, say, making special effort to hear Aki Takahashi mm-hmm. play Cage last Wednesday night out at Bard College. You know, so it's Perilous Night. It's still Cage's composition, mm-hmm. but it's Aki performing that piece. So this is different in the sense that it's a vessel. You know, Cage's piece is a kind of vessel. He's created a space in which the content, if you will, I hate to separate them because form and content in this case and in virtually all of Cage's work is kind of one and the same, or it grows out of it. But the content in this case is someone else. So it more is less a performance than a realization, mm-hmm. which is why I kind of don't use those words interchangeably. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I would think of them still as it's just Cage's piece. Mm-hmm.
It's at this point I have to interject to something I've been grinning about since the thought occurred to me, that this is a permanent installation with all these dimensions that we've talked about. And the other famous permanent installation in Philadelphia is, of course, Etant Donné by Cage's mentor, teacher, friend, pal, Marcel Duchamp. And of course, for those who know that piece, we all know that piece, it arrests your eyes. It captures a singleness of vision. It's located on those great Duchampian topics of eroticism and understanding and
probably 10
soul and what
probably 10
probably
I bet
10.
We could come up with 10
and
things.
10 I mean it goes on and on. We just had a great thing. And so how amazing to also have something stripped bare, stripped in this minimal place, inviting, participatory, verbal, circular, reiterated, utilizing not just the eyes, but the sense of voice as well, and the sense of body and position as you have to sit through there. And you can go on through the tantalizing kind of comparisons and contrasts about the idea of what a possible permanent installation could mean. The enigma, the probably endlessly debated enigma of what Etant Donné means and its references, and I love showing it in my classes as saying, okay, and then he did this. And of course it concludes everything, and yet leads and opens other questions. And Cage here, with his grace and openness and sensibility to begin anywhere, says, no, come in, invite, talk. Make it happen, and be part of another kind of iteration of it. So I think it's a kind of another dimension of that way in which this opens and just opens the door. My favorite moments in the Philadelphia Art Museum are when tourists from different countries come, and they come, they look at the large glass, and they look at the gifts and everything, and they go, well, that's it, and then they leave and go back to their home countries where their friends say, so, did you see it? And they say, what? What? So, but they'll never have the chance here because it's part of what you can hear as well.
I love the pairing of Cage and Duchamp, but I just want to make sure that we're careful that this, you know, the Etant Donné was a really, really, really important piece for Duchamp. It was secretive and it took a long time. And this was really a kind of exploration of Cage's. It was done at the last minute. It was really just something that he did.
You said an afterthought.
It was almost an afterthought. I mean, it's in the program that he was going to do something else. And in fact, he says in his introductory talk, I hadn't known quite what to do for you today, and it's only in the past few days that I've figured out what it is. So I think if this piece, I don't want to put ratios on it, but I think if this piece very much for John Cage, you know, that I think of it as something that he did to work out, he was working through some ideas for himself. And I think a lot of that had to do with improvisation. I think how can he, after the tussle with Anthony Davis, which made him uncomfortable, he didn't like to be, he thought of himself as the great pacifist, you know, the live and let live, the great permission giver. And here he had this tussle. Oh, I don't really think that's useful at all. You know, this is not good. And so I think he had to come to terms with that for himself. So I think it's a very personal piece. I don't think he considered it a great masterwork. He just created a framework in which, through which he himself could experiment with something that was troubling him. I think it was the 11th idea, or the first, and the other one were 10 on top of it. But this was the guiding idea, was improvisation.
And to try to kind of transition somewhat in a different trajectory, we've tried to kind of remain true to that very personal experience that I think maybe Cage had with How to Get Started in 1989 here. And so it's been something that really Ken's been very attentive to, kind of creating a context in which he would have a somewhat, I don't know, disorienting experience almost. Is when I put on the headphones and kind of experimented the other night, it was a very peculiar experience to like speak while you hear yourself talking, layered back temporally upon your present kind of voice. It's a very kind of peculiar experience. I use the word implication, like being implicated by your own thoughts and voices. I don't know if Laura would, but that was one way that I was trying to come to terms with how to describe it. And it's an experience that for all that we've kind of been talking about tonight. Perhaps you just, as Laura said, you have to experience it. Maybe I'll just ask Laura one more question, and then maybe we'll get out of the way and let you get back to the piece itself. We've talked quite a bit about, I think you alluded to it in your performance earlier today, the difficulty of being creative. So I was wondering if maybe you could talk more about the very title, How to Get Started, and Cage's kind of, I guess, how do you read this title? It's something that we've talked about a lot, but I don't know if maybe everybody here tonight has been part of those conversations. The difficulty of being creative, the question of how to get started.
Well, I mean, it was one of my thoughts today that I reflected on in my performance, which was is that what you're referring
to? If you could just share.
Yeah, I'll just share that with you. So what I did for my realization today was to come up with 10 thoughts about John Cage, memories, anecdotes, things that he said that have stayed with me, things that have happened in performances of Cage's works around the world that have been particularly striking for me or noteworthy or troubling. And one of my remembrances of Cage that I built one of my things around was when he was hired, it's a terrible word, engaged by Harvard University as to be the Charles Eliot Norton lecturer in poetry, which is a very, very staid, very serious appointment at Harvard University. And Cage, as most of you know, was really not a staid, not altogether taken seriously person in that echelon. And here he was invited to be the Charles Eliot Norton professor. And he took this very seriously, and he was very proud. And he had been given a mandate for his lectures. And the mandate was simple, as the mandate had been to all the people who had preceded him, which Igor Stravinsky, Italo Calvino, Frank Stella. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. It's just incredible, the people who have held this position. And the mandate was this: just whatever you write in your lectures, make them somehow autobiographical. So he got this mandate and accepted, signed the contract, and came home and paced for months, it felt like. And he just didn't know what to do, and I was his assistant, so I would come to the office, which was his apartment, and I would make busy work all day. And this went on for weeks. It was driving me crazy because he just wasn't, and I took money out of petty cash, and I went to Barnes & Noble down the street, and I came back with all the kind of hip people of the time, Roland Barthes and Derrida and all these people that for me had something to say to John Cage or about John Cage. And I brought them back and I put them in front of him, and he would kind of go and put it on the table unread, which I'm sorry to say, these books are now in his library, so people come and say, "Oh my God, he read Derrida," you know, and this is totally my fault. It's true. It's a true story. So history, you gotta love it, you know. But anyway, the point of the story was simply that at a certain point, I lost my patience with him on day 87, and I said, "God, I would think at your age that this would be easier. You would be used to this." And he said, "No, it just gets harder." And it really struck me when he said, I fell in love with him all over again when he said that, because what it said to me was that he really was the most truly and real experimental person I had ever met, because he was unwilling to do anything unless it meant something to him, unless it was new, unless it was something that he hadn't thought of before, that he was going to bring himself to in a new way, that he was going to give to people that he hadn't given to people before. So it was just an extraordinary moment for me. So he really, in my eyes, could do no wrong after that. It was okay. If he wanted to pace and drink soy milk and dip bread in it, which is what he was doing day in and day out, and walk around the apartment, was just fine with me.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very strange situation, because in the Cage original, I assume it was in a sort of an auditorium, a kind of like open space. And so you're taking something that was in a very open public space and putting it into basically a small metal box that has very peculiar spectral qualities. There's, for instance, a fundamental frequency, and I'll just speak to you directly, Gloria, because you asked the question. There's a fundamental frequency that's just about 60 cycles that is so extreme as a resonance that if you pump in a sine wave at 60 cycles at any volume, the standing waves build up so much that when you talk, it's like talking into a fan. You know, the air is being buffeted that much. When I first walked into the room, when I was first introduced to Aaron through Arthur, you know, I walked into the room and Aaron's talking about a sound insulation, and then as soon as I stepped foot on the floor and you hear this like, I was like, wow, this is quite an interesting situation.
We thought of the perfect room that would make it very easy.
And I'm still fascinated by the room, and I think it's beautiful. I actually think that there should be an extension to this permanent installation that invites sound artists to do something specific with the room, you know, as sort of like a sideline to what else is going on.
We could rent it out.
Yeah. Like an after-hours kind of sound installation thing. But I'm excited to keep working with the room, and I think its spectral qualities are really interesting. I'm excited of the possibility of the different performances that happen in there. The kinds of voices, I mean, every individual voice is going to reveal something different about the space as well, and that's very exciting. It reveals something about the piece and about the space and the relationship of the space to the piece, the relationship of embodiment to spatiality, etc.
And the color and texture of the walls, again, just an empty space. About a day or two ago, it just looked like, you know, somebody's unfinished room in the attic or so. And so Ken's like choices and ways of articulating that were just remarkable to bring out this quality. So and the sight sound relation as well.
It's true.
Good.
Okay.
Our aspiration that Peter was alluding to is that the project will be generative of other projects. And so what you'll see in the next months and hopefully years will be a series of activities, not just within that room, but here as all of our other activities play out, that will take Cage as a continued inspiration.
My feeling about that is also what I was saying about the performative authenticity, is that this piece draws attention to conceptual fidelity. And the permanence is not necessarily in the specific, you know, technological situation, right? I mean, sure, there's going to be at some point, if you create a piece of software, now all of a sudden there's a situation, you upgrade your computer, your operating system, where there's a problem, right? But if you're thinking about the piece in terms of how it unfolds conceptually, there always will be a re-realization technologically that is still authentic to the piece. So do you understand what I'm saying? So I see that as maybe at some point there's a need for the piece to be recreated technologically, but it doesn't have to fall into this kind of abyss of technological obsolescence. Like if you go to the Music Museum in Vienna and see Todd Machover's, you know, installation on the third floor or whatever that's now 10, 15 years old, and it's just nothing really works anymore, and blah, blah, blah. Because it was really about the technology, this isn't about the technology, it's about the concept, so it allows itself to be reimagined technologically at any time.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that it's a permanent installation, but it's not a permanent piece. And that is to say, it's really, the installation is a score, the installation is an environment for continuous kinds of performances, which is kind of one of the geniuses, I think, that comes through out of it or so. So, yeah, and we did kept on talking about that in different ways all the time. And that's kind of another dimension that struck you at some point. Well, no, you don't have to keep doing this with these technologies, with these categories. In fact, it could strip it back very far and bring in other realms. So the structure of the piece, which was, again, Laura, you know, just a series of, I'm going to sit down and do this. I mean, that whole verbal, you know, that kind of oral tradition, this is what I'm going to do, they did it, and now we're going to do it, leaves it open to have other dimensions that become part of the scoring of it and the performance of it. So the installation is, as long as Aaron's here, I guess. Although the designers, what did the designer guy say? he said that the people who did the actual carpentry work and fabrication said, hey, we like to do things and take them places. What will we do this someplace else? They were all excited to make it happen in another place, but I don't know that that will happen.
I mean, the issue of permanence is also important, at least to me, at Slot Foundation, because, I mean, I think the idea, to be quite frank about it, was that there needs to be a way in which cultural institutions can set forth a model that present the public as artists or present the public as potential performers. And this had been maybe a deficiency in how we ourselves practice here and what we aspire to do as opposed to what we actually do. And so the idea was that this would be a fixed space, this will be a fixed space within which that model of the public as a performer and as an artist could be embedded and could always play out.
I just wanted to say one thing that we haven't said enough about, and that is that at any given time, this piece, in its largest sense, becomes an archive of thinking. It becomes a place, a capturing, a picture, if you will, of what people are thinking, you know? And I like that idea very much, you know? It gives voice to my neighbors, you know?
So we hope that we'll see you back. We need to give Peter a little bit of time to finesse the engineering and the software, but we hope that we'll see you back. We hope that you'll stay a little longer tonight and that you'll share the project with your friends. And there's a publication available, and you can also listen to selections of the piece on the website as well. So thank you.
Thanks.